Okay, to start the early modern period, the Ming were really pretty prosperous. The Europeans had first brought their ships into the South China Sea and started to sort of enter China by way of the ocean in the early 1500s. So as the Europeans are sort of exploring to the west, I should say, going to the Americas, and the Spanish and the Portuguese are heavily involved in the colonization of North and South America and the Caribbean. They're also starting to show up in the east, in China particularly. So the Europeans first arrive in China by sea in the early 1500s. Now, you know they had been there by land earlier, but not really in large numbers. It's really when they arrived by sea in the early 1500s that regular relations between the Chinese and the Europeans starts on a large scale. The Chinese by this time had advanced technology in mass production, particularly the mass production of porcelain, silk, and lacquerware furniture. Lacquerware furniture is, if you can imagine, a Chinese restaurant, the furniture, it's kind of gaudy. It's usually red and really, really shiny. Okay, this is lacquerware furniture. These goods were being mass-produced using assembly lines in large government-owned factories. So the Chinese were able to put out quite a large amount of these types of goods. When the Europeans arrived in the late 1500s, the Europeans just really, really were excited about this stuff, particularly porcelain and silk. And they started to purchase large amounts of Chinese porcelain and silk, and lacquer furniture as well, to a lesser extent, using silver, which was obviously coming from Spanish America. Okay. So Europeans consuming porcelain, silk, purchasing it with silver from the Americas. It's not just the Spanish and the Portuguese, actually. It's not really the Spanish at all, mostly the Portuguese. The Portuguese established a port in China early on in the south, and then the Dutch and the British get involved during the early modern period as well, purchasing the silk and the porcelain, and to a lesser extent the lacquerware furniture. They purchased so much porcelain from the Chinese that any kind of fine dinnerware in England became known as china. It's where we get the whole idea of a china cabinet, and this really comes largely during this early modern period when the Europeans are actually able to go directly to China to purchase the stuff. Now, it had already entered China before this via the Indian Ocean trade. I'm sorry, it had already entered Europe before this. The Europeans had been buying Chinese porcelain before this time period. However, it's when the Europeans actually arrive in China via the oceans, and they actually are in control of the Indian Ocean trade routes themselves, that you get large-scale importation of Chinese porcelain and silk into European markets. Like I said, Chinese goods were traded for silver, which originally came from the Americas. This large-scale consumption of Chinese goods by the Europeans spurred growth both in the urban areas and in the rural areas. In the rural areas, they produced agricultural goods for this newly created urban elite. The urban areas were growing in large scale, largely as a result of this new wealth that was pouring in from the trade. So you had a growing urban elite. We've talked about this before in China. This isn't the first time China's had an urban elite. We've talked about it in other dynasties as well. But again, we have a resurgence, I guess I should say, not a new, but a resurgence of a wealthy urban elite in Chinese cities consuming all kinds of luxury goods and living off the food produced in the countryside. As a result, the countryside is doing quite well as well, quite well also, producing food to support the urban population. In fact, many of the landowners, the guys who actually owned the land in the countryside, moved to the cities to engage in this sort of consumer lifestyle, this sort of urban elite lifestyle that was developing in Chinese cities during the Ming period. Hold on just a second. Okay, anyway, so we get a growing class of urban elite consumers with lots of money buying up luxury goods. So then as a result of that, we get the development of small businesses providing for this new wealthy class. They're providing things like printing services, tailors, paper, ink, brushes for Chinese script. So all these kind of consumer goods being bought up. So we have the development of a large consumer economy. China's profiting on a large scale during the later part of the Ming Dynasty from trade with Europe. This doesn't last, however, and ultimately the influx of Spanish silver helps lead to an economic depression, which contributes to the decline of the Ming Dynasty, which we'll learn about on the next slide. So let's go ahead and transition, please. The big story, though, for the Ming Dynasty during the early modern period is really its decline. China is really dominated more so by the Qing Dynasty that follows the Ming Dynasty during this period. So we really need to talk about how this transition occurs. What happens to the Ming Dynasty? Okay, the first thing that contributes to the decline of the Ming Dynasty is environmental. It's what we call the Little Ice Age. It affected the whole world. It was a climate change that really reached its worst in about 1645. 1645 was really the coldest winter that China had seen in generations. Okay, this caused major agricultural problems. It limited agricultural production and caused disease to spread rampantly in northern China. Okay, so we get this cold spell affects the whole world, the whole northern hemisphere. It affects Europe as well, but it's sort of the beginnings of the end for the Chinese. So we have climactic change, a cold spell in China hitting its peak in 1645, causing major problems in agricultural production and widespread disease. Next problem, too much silver. Too much silver is pouring into the economy from the Americas. Europeans are buying up Chinese goods like crazy and using silver to purchase it. As silver pours into the Chinese economy, we get inflation, just like we do everywhere else. The value of the money is decreasing while the price of consumer goods is increasing. People have decreased purchasing power. They can't buy as much as they used to be able to. So this is leading to economic depression. The economic depression is made worse by the Ming policy of producing paper currency. Paper currency had been a failure in the 1350s, and it was a failure in the early modern period as well. By the mid to late 1600s, the Ming producing paper currency as well as copper coins in incredible abundancy led to increased inflation and economic depression. This economic depression led to protests by laborers working in the government-owned silk, porcelain, and lacquer furniture factories, which in turn really led to rebellion in general. So you had strikes among factory workers because the working conditions in the factories were so horrible. In one case, the working conditions were so bad in a Chinese factory that the workers actually threw themselves into the kiln. As you know, porcelain, like other ceramics, has to be baked in an extremely hot oven. The working conditions in some Chinese factories were so bad that the workers protested by actually throwing themselves into the kiln. They'd rather be dead than to continue to work in the factories. So you have economic depression. The laborers are desperate. They're in poor working conditions. They're protesting. In general, the price of consumer goods is going up while the value of the currency is going down. This is a result of the influx of silver and the production of paper money and the production of copper coins. People don't trust the paper money. People don't trust the copper coins. They do trust the silver, but there's just too dang much of it. Okay, so its value is decreasing. We have corruption in the government. These government-owned factories are very poorly run. Okay, they're disorganized, inefficient, and have horrible working conditions, which leads, like I said, to protest by the workers to the extreme that in one case, in 1601, workers at a factory in Jingdezhen, spelled J-I-N-G-D-E-Z-H-E-M, actually throw themselves into a kiln to protest. So from the 1600s, actually going back, starting in maybe 1600, pushing up through 1700, we have economic depression in China. Economic depression leads to hunger, which leads to rebellion among the population. You have a again, a combination of factors here. You have inflation decreasing people's purchasing power. You have a cold spell where agricultural production is decreasing. You have a cold spell also causing disease. Generally, you have an unhappy population, and as a result, you have widespread rebellion within the empire. The Ming are desperately trying to control these rebellions while they're having problems with, again, yes, pesky northern nomads. This time, it's a new Mongol federation. In around 1600, a guy named Gladen, a Mongol leader, managed to reunify the Mongol tribes and really wreak havoc on the Ming's northwestern borders. So the Mongols are again causing problems for the Chinese, for the Ming in particular, along their northwestern border. Meanwhile, the Manchu on their northeastern border are gaining power as well. So if you look at the map of China there, see that sort of dotted line that goes through the red area in the top. That's Mongolia. So you have the Mongols causing trouble up there and also a little bit further to the west. They're now unified again under this new Mongol Khan, Gladden. They're also unified under the Dalai Lama. The Dalai Lama, of course, being the spiritual leader of Tibetan Buddhism. The Mongols, by this point, have converted to Tibetan Buddhism, and their sort of unity as Tibetan Buddhists brings them together both spiritually under the Dalai Lama and politically under this guy named Gladden, and this is in around 1600. So this new unity is causing problems for the Ming. Another group further to the west, if you look at that little part that sticks up from China above Beijing, this is Manchuria. The Manchu people are growing in strength. The Manchu get a leg up with the invasion of the Japanese, which we talked about earlier. The Japanese invade Korea, take over Korea, and attack northern China. When they attack northern China, they weaken the northern Chinese garrisons. So they weaken China's ability to defend its northern borders. Again, causing more problems for the Ming. Weakening these northern garrisons allows the Manchu to start penetrating in to northern China and causing more problems there. So the Ming Chinese are you know, trying to fight off these northern invaders, the Mongols and the Manchu. Meanwhile, in southern China, Japanese pirates are raiding the Chinese coast in southeast China. And the army is so busy dealing with the pesky northern nomads that they really don't have an opportunity to come south and defend the southeastern coast of China from Japanese pirates. As a result, the Chinese living in this region get fed up and head south into Southeast Asia because they see opportunities to engage in the Indian Ocean trade if they head south out of China into Southeast Asia. So we get a migration of Chinese away from the Japanese pirates heading south into Southeast Asia. Okay, the Japanese pirates are beating up on the Chinese from about 1592 to 1598. It's about that time anyway. Rebellion, invasion, all causing problem for the Qing. The ultimate demise of the Qing dynasty comes with rebellion. A Chinese rebel, I guess, I don't need to be more specific than that. His name was Li Zhengxi, I think is how you say it. Li Zhengying, let's say. But anyway, that's not important. You don't need to know his name. Anyway, Chinese rebel in a rebellion, which was, of course, common by this point in Ming China, manages to seize Beijing. Okay, so in a rebellion, the city of Beijing is taken by a Chinese rebel. A Ming general, in desperation, flees north to the Manchu, makes a deal with the Manchu, says, please help me retake the city of Beijing. So a Ming general makes an alliance with the Manchu to try and drive this rebel, Chinese rebel, out of Beijing. So this Ming general, in combination with a Manchu force, invades Beijing and takes Beijing. Problem is, the Manchu don't go home. They keep it, and they take over China, and they establish the Qing dynasty, okay, China's last dynasty. And the Ming are gone forever. Okay, so we are done. Let's go ahead and wrap it up.